Welcome to Wealthion. I'm Wealthion founder Adam Taggart here, welcoming you back for another weekly market recap featuring our market expert, Lance Roberts. Lance, how you doing today?
It's been an interesting week.
Yeah, well, you know, a different week from the past several. This one just seems to have been a very positive week for the markets after a lot of past negativity and volatility. Let's start with a theme for the week. What kind of theme you want to give this one?
Rebound rally. That's what it was.
All right, rebound rally. So, you know, it looks like the markets started the week around S&P 4100. They're over 44 something now. So, yeah. You know, kind of close to a 10% bounce in just one week, right?
Yeah, look, you know, these type of bounces are not uncommon. You know, during this type of a market, you know, we talked about last week, you know, missing out the 10 best days of the year, that type of thing. So, you know, this was, you know, very expected. We've been talking about getting a bounce here and that we would do that. And again, sentiment's been very negative. Positioning has been very negative. Lots of cash that, you know, money managers had sitting on their balance sheet. They had to get that cash back to work. And this is also heading into the end of the quarter. So, you know, this is also where money managers have to have that cash allocated in order to bill on it. So, you know, there's a lot of incentive here to put cash to work. But we got the Fed behind us. Things are calming. You know, the world hasn't gone into nuclear war with Russia. So the markets are starting to discount what's happening in Russia and Ukraine to a degree. And let's go back to our conversation last Friday. We talked about how the cure for high oil prices was high oil prices. On Monday, we sold down our energy stocks and we had a very nice correction in energy prices, which also pulled some of that pressure off of markets as well. So kind of a culmination of events between short squeezes as well as just, and as we said last week, just any positive news at all was going to elicit a fairly strong rally. And we saw that this week with the market actually closing above the 50-day moving average.
All right, so we did get back up to the 50-day moving average. Great, I want to talk about that for a second, but a quick correction. I just sort of went and did my math a little bit better after you started giving your answer. Not so much a 10% increase in the market this week, but more like a 6 to 7%, which is still pretty substantial for a single week. So we were talking last week about, you know, if there was going to be a bounce, what would you be looking at to determine whether or not it was an opportunity, sort of a rebound to sell on, or whether we were going to bounce back maybe to all-time highs? And you said, well, the first milestone you were going to look at there was the 50-day moving average. So it looks like we did get up, and sounds like we've not just hit it, but we passed through it a little bit.
We do. But now, unfortunately, you know, last week when we talked about this, we didn't have the death cross in place, which is where the 50-day moving average crosses below the 200-day moving average. So yes, good news, we crossed above the 50-day on Friday, but now we have the 200-day sitting just above closing prices. So if we're going to make a move towards, you know, higher levels, we need to close above that 200-day moving average, you know, Monday or Tuesday. If we don't, then potentially we're going to see this rally kind of start to sell off a bit. And then we'll have to see that, and we'll have to make sure that those January lows hold, because that was the previous level of support that we've now gotten above as well. So above the 50-day, that's good news. If we do get a pullback next week, wouldn't be surprising. You know, you got a 6% move in a week, and that's a very big move, a lot of short covering. So a little bit of sell-off next week wouldn't be surprising, but we need to hold those January lows, not the Russia lows. So again, those January lows come back into important focus because that was also the lows back in early September.
All right, and just ballpark S&P, where is that sort of January low threshold?
So really we need to hold above 4,300 in order to really kind of keep this upward trend in motion. So, you know, what's key here is that we set a low the day that Russia invaded Ukraine. The next low that we set was a little bit higher than that low. So the good news here is that over the last couple of weeks, we are starting to establish a pattern of some higher lows. That's a bullish trend. And so the next low that we set, either next week or the week after, needs to be a higher low than what we set previously. So as long as we can keep doing that and working our way higher, this kind of bullish trend can persist, but don't take me and say, oh, well, he's just getting all bullish. We're just to the point right now to where we're starting to have an opportunity to potentially rebalance some risk in portfolios. We still have a lot of problems ahead of us. You know, we've got the Fed hiking rates. We've got, you know, earnings are going to slow down. Economic growth is going to slow down. So we're not out of the woods just yet in terms of a, you know, more volatile market as we go forward over the next few months.
Okay. I want to dig into those issues in just a second. So when you talk sort of technically about seeing if we're going to cross, you know, catch up to the 200-day moving average, and whether we're going to sort of continue to build a more bullish base here, how long do you expect the tape to tell that story? Is that something that you're going to be looking at over just a matter of the next couple of weeks or two, or could this play out over months before you feel like you have a sense for which way this is going to move?
I think we'll have a better sense really probably over the next week or so. Again, you know, this rally that we saw this week was a technical short covering rally. That's what that was. Don't read anything more into that. We just had a lot of people on the wrong side of the tape, a lot of negative sentiment. A lot of people were short markets, a lot of people were short stocks. So when you get a rally, you're going to get this fair. And this is what we were saying over the last couple of weeks, is that when we get this rally, any piece of good news is going to be a fairly strong rally because you have all this negative sentiment. Everybody's on the same side of the boat. The world's about to end. So if you have any type of good news, everybody's going to run in the other direction, which is exactly what we saw. So now we need to see things calm down a bit and start to see markets moving 2% a day. We go back to the markets moving, you know, up or down 0.5% a day, and just see kind of a steady flow in one direction or the other. And if we start to see more positive aspects to the markets, then that would suggest that maybe the markets have digested, you know, the first few rate hikes, and that we might see April, May, June might be kind of a more normalized markets to the upside, give us an opportunity to trade a bit here, make a little bit of money, rebalance some risk. But again, as I said, once we get into summer and later on this year, I think there's going to be some more downside pressure because of what the Fed is doing and because of what's going to happen economically.
All right. Well, let's now talk directly about that. So you just put out a piece, I believe today, quite recently, titled Recession Risk Rising Rapidly, or Could We Be in One Already? We talked a bit about this last week, but I think it's worth digging into this again, because the Fed indeed did come out 2 days ago and announced that, yeah, we are tightening rates. And they issued the first rate hike in several years. We got a full 25 basis points out of them, which I've got a little funny meme to show in just a minute to sort of show how tiny that is versus what the situation really needs right now. In fact, let me just show it right now.
Okay.
Yeah. So anyways, I love that video, Lance. It really shows drives home the visual of how insufficient at least this very first rate hike is for the problem at hand. But that said, Jerome Powell did say that the Fed was likely to hike, I think, 6 or 7 times more this year. Yep. So he's talking very tough. But anyway, so you put out this piece here that basically says recession risk is rising, along with the cost of capital, now that yields have been rising since the start of the year, and the Fed is now finally actively adding fuel to that fire. And you've got a lot of great charts and data here that basically show, hey, oftentimes, you know, by the time we wait to be told we're in a recession, you know, it may already even be over in certain cases. Right. So let's dig into what you wrote here.
Well, so I mean, that's really kind of the key thing, is you're going to hear a lot of commentary over the course of the next couple of months that says, oh, the economy's doing just fine. We're not in a recession. There's no evidence we're in a recession, blah, 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 right? You need to be long stocks because there's no evidence of a recession. That's the way we always are. And back in, let me give you a good example. Back in December of 2007, I wrote an article that said we are about to be in or are in the worst recession since the Great Depression. Ben Bernanke had come out in just a couple of months prior to that and said, we're not in a recession. He came out again in early 2008, March of 2008, Ben Bernanke says, subprime is contained, no risk of a recession. When we got to December of 2008, a full year later, the National Bureau of Economic Research came out and said, oh yeah, the recession, it started in December of 2007. Now the markets were down 50% at that point. It didn't do you any good now that the National Bureau of Economic Research dated the recession. It had already happened and the damage was over. And the problem is that if you're looking at economic data today, that is not the number it's going to be in 12 months and 3 years from now. Because the Bureau of Economic Analysis adjusts their data. After the year has passed, they go back and revise all the numbers. In 3 years, they go back and revise the numbers for the previous 3 years. So what the National Bureau of Economic Research has to wait for is for those revisions. So by the time those revisions come along, they're 9 months, 12 months too late in dating the recession. So, you know, waiting for it's not, you know, it's not going to be beneficial for your portfolio. We've got to understand that the risk we have today suggests that we will likely be in a recession within 12 to 15 months. And it could be even sooner because we haven't been in this environment since the 80s where we had 8% inflation in terms of CPI. So that could advance the recession a whole lot quicker than would be the case if we were running at 2% inflation. So the Fed is hiking rates. The market is currently pricing in 8 rate hikes this year, including the one that just happened. So 7 more after this one. There's not that many meetings. So that means a couple of those meetings have to be half basis point hikes. There's no way that you're going to hike rates to that degree in an economy that is going to print about a 1% growth rate in the first quarter. So you just simply don't have that much wiggle room. The inflation's a problem. Economic growth is slowing. Earnings estimates are way too high. Those have to come down. And as those economic those earnings estimates come down, that means forward valuations go up, which makes it very difficult to justify paying those asset prices in that type of a market. So the point here is that no matter how you kind of look at this, there's not a lot of upside for economic growth between now and the end of the year because all that liquidity that was fueling the growth over the last 2 years, checks to households, you know, unemployment benefits, expanded child tax credits, those are all gone. Consumers are facing a world where their wages aren't keeping up with inflation. And I just posted a good chart this morning on Twitter, which showed, you know, basically a, you know, the difference between nominal retail sales and real retail sales. And what it shows is what we already know is that you're paying a whole lot more for the same amount of stuff. So when you look at retail sales and say, oh, retail sales were really strong last month. Not really. You just paid a lot more in dollar volume.
It's just the inflation tax being added onto the existing transactions. Yeah,
exactly. And so you're not buying any more stuff. And so for consumers, they've got to make the decision, okay, I'm not going to buy a new pair of shoes because I got to put gas in my car. And that's going to be something that shows up later this year. And that's not being factored in to a lot of this data just yet.
Yeah, well, you know, so going back to your point about not reading too much into this week's activity, I think, you know, a logical person looking from the sidelines would say, wow, wait a minute. You know, the Fed basically just started the new regime of quantitative tightening, said it's going to hike, you know, 7 more times this year. There's probably going to be some double digit hikes in there, or some 50 basis point hikes in there, like you said. And markets rally strongly on that, right? I mean, it's again, it sort of shows that the market was probably rallying for more short-term reasons, like you said it was. Right. And we should really hold off before we say, hey, maybe the tide's turned here and we're back to some sort of bullish trend. Because yeah, when you add up, you know, the macro factors that you just listed there, that's a really pretty good argument that, hey, not only might the economy be in recession later this year, or maybe now, But if it is, you know, it's pretty understandable that asset prices are probably going to follow along the same trajectory.
Yeah. And look, I'm not saying that, you know, we're about to have a 50% crash in the market or anything like that. That's a possibility, right? You know, the problem is that if something breaks, and that's the big issue here, right? The Fed's hiking rates, and they hike rates historically until they break something. And I just put a chart out this morning that has all of the historical rate hikes and relative to inflation and then the ultimate recession. And the important thing to take away that chart is simply this, is that there's never been a single period ever in history where the Fed was hiking rates that you didn't wind up in a recession ever, right? So if that's the history, then history suggests that they're going to hike rates until they break something and we're going to be in a recession, which means that either stocks are going to crash 50% or the Fed's going to be back with QE and zero interest rates sooner rather than later.
Yeah. You know, I was talking to Alfonso Pecatiello, known as Macro Alf on Twitter. He's a bond market guy, and he was basically, you know, saying, look, this is what the bond market's saying. And as of the time we were talking, which was just a couple of days ago, he said, bond market says that Fed's going to hike 7 times. That's pretty consistent with what Powell announced. And after I had interviewed Alf, but he said the bond market said no more additional rate hikes after that. And then looks like in 2024, rate cuts again, it's pricing in. So, you know, sort of the bond market is saying, we think once the Fed funds rate is up to 2%, that's when things are going to break.
Yeah. I've got an active bet going on Twitter right now. I've got the under on that. I'm saying, I don't think they make it more between 1 and maybe 1.5% at most before they break something. I'm probably leaning closer to the 1% mark, but I don't think they make it very far before something breaks. Not with near 8% inflation.
Yeah. Well, and I think Stephanie Pomboy has even got the more aggressive under you. I don't even think she thinks they're going to make it much above 50 basis points. But it'll be interesting. And we're not going to have that long to find out here. But anyways, back to my original point, which is just sort of, you know, if you look at the macro story, it's tilting more and more towards, you know, these sort of deflationary and very bearish outcomes. Market hasn't quite gotten that memo yet, or maybe the market knows something we don't. Well, but it's not going to take us that long to find out at this pace of rate hikes that the Fed's talking about. I also just want to return to something you said about how so much this is, you can use this, you know, in so many cases with sort of today's society, but in a lot of cases the exact indicators that we as a society look to tell us what's going on oftentimes don't give us the answer until it's too late to do anything about it. Mm-hmm. And in certain cases, they give us the wrong answer. And when we can say the markets have been giving us, quote unquote, the wrong answer for years because of all the central bank intervention distorting true price signals, right?
Right.
But anyways, I sort of liken it to imagine your house burning down and you're walking through the rubble. And you're trying to just find pieces of your life that might have survived the fire. And lo and behold, there's a fire alarm, right, from your ceiling. And you pick it up. And as you hold it, it starts beeping. And I feel like that's what these, you know, the NBR and those organizations, NBR and those types of organizations are just like that. They're so late that they're not useful at all. So we need to be looking at other indicators. And you said here in your report here that, you know, the market has often told us in advance, or at least it's been one of the earlier indicators that trouble might be coming. We just need to be listening to those signals. Mm-hmm. So, you know, right now we have had, even though they've had a good week, we've had stocks, you know, down pretty materially since the beginning of the year. More importantly, the bond market with the yield curves, many of which have started inverting now, is warning us. I mean, that's a classic sign that a recession's on the way, right? So, you know, tell folks here, what should we be paying particular attention to right now?
There's three things that, and I wrote an article about this a while back, but also mentioned it in this article too. It's also in this weekend's newsletter. I'm kind of going over this very same thing this weekend. There's three things to pay attention to, because if you know, the market is a result of the actions of people's expectations. And the yield curve, the Fed hiking interest rates, and the Fed tapering their balance sheet all precede a recession. And if we go back and look right now, so the Fed is hiking rates. Now, it doesn't mean you have a recession immediately, but that's kind of your key kickoff point, right? So that starts the clock ticking. And the yield curves start to invert. Now, let's step back here for a second. What does an inverted yield curve mean? So an inverted yield curve is when the short end of interest rates, so that's your 1 year, 2 year, 3 year interest rates, have a interest rate that is higher than your longer term rates. So the differential is negative. And so the differential, as an example, between the 2 year treasury, just as an example, let's say the 2 year treasury is yielding 2% and the 10-year treasury is yielding 1.5%. So you have a negative yield differential between those two. So that's an inversion of that yield spread. Now, what that tells you is that there's problems economically, because in the economy, you should not be able to charge more money for a 2-year loan versus a 10-year loan. The 10-year loan should have a naturally higher rate because of duration and the amount of risk that I've got to take to loan Adam money for 10 years versus 2 years. But when that inverts, that tells you that there's a lot of concern about economic activity or concern about repayment of capital. And if you want to borrow short-term capital, I'm charging you more for it because I'm concerned you're not going to pay me back. And that tells you a lot about what's happening with the monetary mechanism in the economy. And that's telling you there's trouble. Now, here's the thing about inverted yield curves. We talked about this earlier. Oh, the economy, you're going to hear a lot from the media. Market's rallying, the bottom's in, the economy's just fine, nothing to worry about. Be careful of that. You're also going to hear this. See, the yield curve inverted, but the economy's not in a recession. Everything's fine. This time's different. You know, the last time they said that was in 2019. In 2019, we wrote an article writing specifically saying, look, we are either in or about to be in a recession because of the inversion of the yield curves. And what you will know when you're actually in the recession, you will know because it's when those yield curves uninvert and they go back positive, because that's when the economy has now crashed and money is flying into longer duration bonds for safety. And of course, early 2020, we're in a recession, right? And markets are down 35%. The yield curve uninverts drastically because money's just pouring into long-dated treasuries. Yields fall below 1%. That's what's going to happen again this time. You're going to hear a lot of economic commentators talking about, oh, don't worry about it. Yield curve's inverted. This time's different. Yeah, I know it's got a perfect track record for the last 50 years that the inverted yield curve always predicts recession. But hey, this time, ignore it. Don't ignore it. The inversion of the yield curve is not the start of a recession. It tells you one is coming. When it uninverts, that's when you want to be in cash and bonds.
Okay. And so the inversion of the yield curve is not when the problem happens. The problem happens after the inverted yield curve uninverts, but it has to invert first to be able to uninvert. And what we're seeing now is more and more, there are many yield curves out there, but more and more of them are now inverted. The 5-10 spread's inverted, the 3-10, the 3-5. I mean, there's a whole bunch of these different ones that people look at.
Ask me the important question. Which one, so out of 10 different commonly watched yield spreads, which one is the most important?
Well, answer that one for us.
All of them. Here's the important thing. You'll hear a lot of people talking about, oh, the 10-2, the 3-7, the 5-2.
I would say the 10-2 gets talked about the most, and that one has yet to invert, but it's getting close.
It's getting very close. But when you are moving into an economic problem, they will all invert. And that's your real telltale sign that you've got a problem going on. So it's not one of them that's important. It's all of them. And when they all invert, that's when you need to start really paying attention to where you've got capital And this is where I'll be buying bonds hand over fist at this point, by the way, because they will shortly, and it doesn't take, but generally a couple of months to just a few months at most. But once all those curves invert, and they historically always invert just before a recession, when they uninvert, they all uninvert at the same time as well. And that is exactly the moment that something breaks. It's not a slow one inversion. It may be a slow little decline into inversion, but it's a rocket ship coming out of the inversion. And okay, so when that happens, that's when you want to be careful.
All right, folks. So the analogy in my mind here, and correct me if you disagree with this one, Lance, but it's like stepping on a landmine, right? Your problem isn't when you step on the landmine, because that's when you activate it. The problem is when you step off it, right? And that's when the explosion happens. So looks like we are stepping our foot on the landmine. We're hearing that click. We're now going to be waiting for whatever period of time for us to determine what we're going to do. But at some point, that foot's going to come off the landmine and that quick explosion that you're talking about is going to happen. So we'll obviously be tracking this closely every week by week, you know, in this weekly market recap video. But Lance, so let's say the 210s inverts tomorrow and you know, pretty much across the board, they're inverted. You know, you're saying, hey, it might be months before we get that explosive denouement to this story. What's going to tell you when it's the right time to go to cash and bonds?
Well, you know, that's always the tricky part, right? Is trying to exactly time that moment. And I wouldn't try to time it because, again, what causes it to... So here, let's go back to 2020 as an example, okay? So 2019, in August of 2019, we write an article talking about the coming recession. There's a yield curve inversion that's happening. Behind the scenes, we've got the Fed doing QE behind the scenes on this repo bailout because they were bailing out hedge funds. Nobody was paying attention to it, but they were doing a massive amount of repo trying to keep hedge funds from blowing up. So here we are, August, September, October, November, December, January, February. Now in February, we were writing an article about you need to start reducing risk, taking money off the table. There's something coming, don't know what it is. But we started seeing those cracks in the markets. Now remember, markets were, this is the interesting thing, markets were at all-time highs at that point.
Right.
And we were talking about super high valuations, and we've been in a market meltup.
Right. So, and sorry to interrupt, but just to underscore your point, if you had started shorting the market when the yield curve inverted, you'd have been losing money all that time through.
Correct. And then, so in February, we started seeing the cracks in the foundation. We said, hey, let's reduce risk. And then, and look, we just, in February, we were just hearing about this virus over in China, right? Just people were talking about it, but it wasn't here yet. And then just a couple of weeks later, we shut down the whole economy, right? And this whole and the whole ball of wax comes undone. Money flies into bonds. The yield curve drastically spikes up. But if you waited for that to occur, you were down 30% before you knew it. That was a 35% correction over 3 weeks. Right. You didn't have a chance to do anything about it. You've got to, when you see these things occur, you've got to start taking risk. And look, you're going to underperform markets for a couple of months, 3 months, 4 months, 5 months, right? That's going to happen. That's just, you know, that's who cares? You know, it's interesting now too, you know, I'm reading a lot of stuff. People go, well, valuations are back to where they were in 20, you know, pre-pandemic, 29, you know, 2020, we're back to those valuations. They weren't cheap then. it's not cheap now. You know, but this is the idiocy of the media, right? So, yeah, well, if things are almost back to where they were they weren't great pre-pandemic either, but you know, we were overvalued, overbought, overextended, and yes, we've had this correction now, but prices have a long ways to fall just to get back to those levels. Valuations are still at 37 times earnings. I mean, markets are not cheap by any stretch of the imagination. Now we've blown a lot of stocks out the out of the market here lately. So, you know, the Snowflakes, the Asanas, a lot of those companies. I was looking at Alibaba, right? That stock is down like 90% from its peak. I mean, it's just gotten crushed in this market. So we talked about this before. There's been a big bear market underneath the surface. And so there is some value out there, and it's certainly worth paying attention to. And those stocks, there's going to be a lot of those companies that they've already been taken out to the woodshed. So they may not have a lot lower to go, but that doesn't mean they also have a lot of room to the upside either. So, you know, you're going to have to be very selective about navigating this market over the next few months. I do caution you against being very bearish. There's a lot of really big bearish commentary out there right now. Markets are very oversold. They are very negative. We have a prime setup here for a decent rally. Doesn't mean we're going off to new highs. Doesn't mean that I'm super bullish on markets. Just understand that markets go up and they go down, and they tend to go up more often than they go down. So our job is to make money and to do it safely. But, you know, there's opportunities exist right now. As I said earlier, we put on some additional exposure earlier this week. We reduced some of our energy exposure earlier this week. Do we still own energy stocks? Yes. We just moved them back to model weight because they had a huge run up with oil prices at $130 a barrel. So just rebalance risk, manage your portfolio accordingly, and try not. And again, as we talked about last week, be careful about making one-sided bets, because this market is going to frustrate you over the course of the next few months. If you're long, you're going to get, you know, if you're 100% long, you're going to be frustrated. If you're 100% short, this market's going to frustrate you, and it's going to push you out of your short positions at exactly the wrong time. They're going to push you into long positions at exactly the wrong time, but that's how markets work. And reflexive rallies in particular, the reason that bear markets are so hard is because bear markets will suck you in, because you'll get a nice big rally that looks like the return of the bull market. The bear market will suck you in and then chew you up and spit you out. So, you know, this is, you've got to be real careful how you navigate this market.
Well, good warning. And yeah, given, I mean, I think you're absolutely right about kind of the whole point of a bear market, right? That's what it's trying to do, is extract as much losses from people as possible. And a lot of that are these sort of, you know, bull traps that it sets, right?
Yeah.
But I think what makes this situation even more complicated is if the fundamentals are deteriorating in the way that I think, you know, we think they are, the players can become increasingly desperate, or at least take increasingly extreme action. And as an example for that, one of the reasons why some of the Chinese stocks did so tremendously well yesterday, I think Alibaba was up like 37%. Mm-hmm. I think that the Chinese stock market was up something like that. I mean, the entire stock market was up that much. And the reason for that was because China basically said, all right, you know what? Like, they kind of had their Mario Draghi. We're going to do whatever it takes to make sure that things have a happy ending here. So they're talking a big game about, look, you know, we'll intervene as much as it's going to take to support what goes on here. Will they? Who knows? We'll time will tell. But you know, you've got big players that can make big sweeping moves like that here, which as an investor you just can't predict, right? So it's to your point about sort of just volatility and frustration on all sides. We have to reserve some brain space that there's just going to be these exogenous surprises that come in here on both sides.
Well, and again, you know, if you look at the Hang Seng Index as an example, I don't know the exact decline amount, but it was down 40-50%. So, you know, it had been in a major bear market already. So, you know, it wasn't surprising that, you know, China came in with the massage parlor, you know, type view here. It's like, well, you know, we're going to do whatever it takes to give you a happy ending. And but you know, that, you know, if, and again, this is the same thing that's going to happen here in the States. You know, don't think for a moment that if we're down 20, 30, 40%, that the Fed doesn't go, I'm out, you know, rates are going back to zero. We're going to do $2 trillion in QE every month, you know, whatever it is, you know, and mind you, the QE, so we were doing $120 billion a month last time, which was more than the $80 billion a month we did before that, which was more than the $50 billion a month we did before that one. So every QE we have to do has to keep getting bigger and bigger and bigger in order to have an effect on the market. So don't think for a moment that the next QE won't be $200 billion a month. The only thing that limits the Fed is debt issuance. So as long as the Treasury is issuing debt and pushing debt out there that they can monetize, you know, they can keep doing QE for a very long time. The problem for the Fed becomes efficacy of that QE and the effectiveness in the markets. But look, let's talk about a couple of bullish things here just for a moment that are supporting stock prices. You still have record stock buybacks. You have a record amount of global equity inflows into markets. I don't know where the money's all coming from, but there's just money literally pouring into the markets. And it's been pouring into the U.S. market in particular at a record pace over the course of the last 2 years.
Yeah, so, I'd start to interrupt, but I think that's Brent Johnson's dollar milkshake there, which is when the rest of the world gets nervous, you know, it flees to the U.S.
Exactly.
Capital flees to the U.S.
Yeah, well, I mean, where do you want it? You want it in Russia?
Well, you can't even put it there now if you wanted to, but no.
Exactly right. So, so, you know, my point is again, this kind of goes back to our conversation. Look, I don't have any clue as to where this market will be at the end of this month, much less 3 months from now, much less than 12 months from now. And anybody telling you that they know where the market's going to be by the December is either has no money invested in the markets or they're just flat out lying because they don't know. Nobody knows. You know, we can make best guesses and we can make some assumptions. And if everything remains status quo as it is today, I can say, yeah, with absolute certainty, if everything is just as it is today, I can make a very good guess at where markets will be by the end of this year. But look, things are going to change. The Fed's going to stop hiking rates, so they're going to hike more than expected. Inflation is going to be stronger than we expect, or it's going to be weaker than we expect. You know, money flows into the U.S. are going to be stronger than we expect or weaker than we expect. We don't know. Things are going to change and dynamics are going to change and markets are going to change because of those dynamic changes. What we do know is valuations are elevated. We do know that forward returns off high valuations are historically low. That we can pretty much take to the bank, along with high inflation slowing economic growth. That's going to happen. Those things we can bet on. The rest of this is something we're going to have to navigate. And that's why I keep going back to this. Be careful about one-sided bets. I'm getting a lot of emails and comments from people listening to this video every week, and I appreciate them. Feel free to email me. I'm happy to do it. I'll answer your questions, whatever you want. That's why I'm here. But I'm getting a lot of questions like, well, I'm long this one thing. My whole portfolio is this, you know, and I disagree with you because the world's coming to an end and we're all going to be living in a cave and you know, sharing, you know, deer skin as clothes. Maybe it's possible, but I wouldn't bet on it. The U.S. economy has a resilience to it, and the U.S. population has a resilience to it that repeatedly frustrates those type of very one-sided bets. So, you know, have part of your one-sided bet. That's completely fine to hedge for risk. That's awesome. But don't discount, you know, the ability for markets to do stuff that you absolutely are convinced that it won't do, because that's the one thing that the market is almost guaranteed to do, is the one thing you're guaranteed that you will guarantee it won't do.
Yeah. And I mean, I won't take us back down the rabbit hole of diversification and whatnot, because we've gone deep on that on previous videos. But I can say, to echo you, you know, my previous role before launching Wealthion, the company I ran before, you spent a lot of time focused on a lot of similar issues, and dollar debasement and inflation was one of them. And you know, I remember people back in 2010, 2011, moving all of their chips on the dollar is going to hyperinflate to zero within the year bet, because they were just so absolutely convinced it was going to. And to be honest, back then, you could still make a really good case that, you know, for that argument, right? So my point is just being, you know, as 100% convicted as you may feel about something, as Lance is saying, reality rarely ever plays out 100% the way that you think it's going to in your mind. So, you know, I would say the more convinced or convicted you are that something's going to happen, that probably makes an even stronger argument that you should at least hedge that in some way for the alternative happening. Right. And then again, too, just diversification has shown over many, 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 many decades that it really is kind of the best strategy out there. And, you know, even if you feel real strongly about something, it probably shouldn't be like a 90-10 weighting on your principal conviction versus your hedge. You should probably have a whole bunch of 15% ones, you know, with maybe like a 35% on the one that you think is most likely.
You know, that's a great point. You know, I got no less than probably 10 emails this week of Ray Dalio's latest article. And, you know, it's interesting, and I'm going to answer. I'm going to say something about what your last statement here, but I'm going to lead with this. I did a chart for one of the gentlemen that emailed me that article, and I labeled it every time that Ray Dalio, going back to 2014, has said cash is trash. And that was basically the best buying opportunity to put money to work almost every single time. So, you know, it's important here. And there's a portfolio allocation that if you're absolutely convinced that the dollar, the demise of the dollar is coming, and that the world is going to end and we should all be in bunkers with beanie weenies and black bean soup, that's okay. Build your portfolio where you've got 35% of your portfolio in high dividend, high quality companies that grow earnings, grow dividends steadily over time. Doesn't really matter whether the economy is in a recession or not. These companies just churn out earnings on a real regular basis. Look, these are boring, dull companies. They are not going to go up 40% in a day, but they're going to protect your capital over time. Economies will grow over time. Have part of your money in your precious metals trade, right? Have part of your money in, currency diversification. So there's multiple ways to do that. Run a hedged risk portfolio of buying, for instance, like dollar hedged emerging markets funds or those type of things. But think about how I can diversify my risk and still be bearish all at the same time. And you can do that by structuring your allocation. But if you're long all precious metals, as an example, you know, that's been a terrible hold for the last decade. It's not really hurt you too much, but it really hadn't made you any money. And the goal of our whole, the whole reason we invest is to grow our savings over time. And that's the most important thing that we need to think about. And that brings up another thing about markets as well and cash. Going back to this idea that cash is trash is interesting, because you have to think, I've got an article coming out on this next week talking about this very specific thing, because I get emails saying, well, I've got all my cash is sitting in the bank account and I'm just losing all this money to inflation, right? Because I'm not invested. The problem is that actually that's not true. Let me, before you freak out, hear me out. If I've got cash in a bank account that is used to buy groceries and gas with, that money is losing to inflation because that money has a designated purpose. Money in my IRA, my 401k, I'm not using that money, or even my investment account, I'm not using that money to buy food, gas, and groceries. I'm using that money to buy assets. Well, what's been happening with asset prices over the course of this year so far? Have they been inflating or have they been deflating? Well, they've been deflating in price.
Right. Your cash has appreciated on a relative basis.
So yeah, so we have to, and so that's right. And that's the important thing to learn here is that I'm now buying depreciated assets with dollars. I'm able to buy more of, you know, Snowflake or Asana or whatever I want to buy, more shares of that company than I was in January of this year. So we have to also keep in perspective the view of what my cash is being used for. And my goal over time of investing is to make sure my cash appreciates so that when I take it out of my investments and use it for my living expenses, my retirement, whatever, that it has appreciated over time for the inflation that is being presented by the economy. But people are right now are worrying and they're making decisions with their money based on 8% inflation today that's not going to be here a year from now, but they're making decisions today that could grossly impact the return on capital over time when they actually, that purchasing power of that capital has gone up because of the depreciation of assets. And I know that's a bit of a weird way to look at it, but it's the value of what we can do with our money at appropriate times. And so again, making decisions about how we allocate money and how we risk capital in markets is very important.
That's great. And specifically on cash, this is the whole optionality value of cash that we've talked a little bit about in the past. And I had a video about a month ago of Jim Rickards really going deep on this. I'm really glad you brought this up. I'm looking at the time and just shaking my head that yet again, you know, we're going so much longer than intended here. And I have a couple of big points that I may just have to push off to next week because I don't want to do them justice. But on this point, two things. I want to get your reaction to two things. Yep. You wrote a piece in the past that, talked about the opportunity cost of being in cash, too much cash for too long. I think, a lot of people viewing here, if they look back, over the past bunch of years, there's probably a number of people that, and I would include myself in this camp, that said, I sat on a lot of cash because I just expected things to break sooner and they didn't, right? And a lot of assets appreciated while my cash just sat there. That being said, I want to put up a tweet that I just posted the other day, and I want to get your reaction to it, because what you're saying is germane to it. Despite today's inflation, cash's day in the sun may finally be nigh. We have recession risk increasing. It's the inverting yield curves are warning us. We have rising cost of capital, which could tank the markets, even potentially the real estate market. And the US dollar may strengthen, and that's the dollar milkshake theory.
Right.
Having dry powder to deploy, should these happen, will be a big advantage. Mm-hmm. So I know you're saying here, look, we don't know exactly what's going to happen in the future. Nobody's got a crystal ball, but I think you would agree that those three kind of macro trends I mentioned are ones that we're looking at pretty closely right now. So what do you think about that? Is it time to start thinking, hey, it might be worthwhile to start building at least some portion of your portfolio as a dry powder reserve?
Well, yes. And that's why if you look at our portfolio allocation, by the way, so if you go to our website, I'm a shameless plug here real quick, but I think this will help out a lot of people. If you go to our website, realinvestmentadvice.com, you can subscribe to our weekly newsletter. It's completely free. But every week I post in that newsletter the trades we make and our portfolio allocation model. So, and it's even got sample stock screens to help you pick stocks, maybe give you a little bit better opportunity. But the important thing in there is our portfolio allocation model and the trades we make every week. So you can stay up with what, now that it's delayed because you're getting it a week later, but you'll see what we're doing. So earlier this week, I said we bought some companies. Well, the reason we did is because we were sitting on almost 33% cash, and there was an opportunity to buy some, well, what we considered to be some distressed growth companies at a much cheaper price. But we're still sitting on 30% cash because we feel the real opportunity for buying distressed assets is still coming. And the cash, as we talked about last week or the week before, I can't remember now, is a perfect hedge. I don't have to worry about the markets going up or going down. If I'm short and the markets go up, I lose money. If I'm long, the markets go down, I lose money. Cash, I don't care. I just wait for the right opportunity to deploy that cash. So to your point, Adam, and it's absolutely right. Yeah, having a cash reserve is really important in order to navigate markets. Should you hold that cash reserve for a decade? No. But if you're holding cash for a month or 3 months or 6 months or 9 months or 12 months, 15 months, that's not losing money relative to inflation. That's the big mistake everybody's making. Probably you're going to be able to deploy that cash at a much better level in terms of buying assets cheaper, which means that dollar value appreciated, as we just said, over the course of that period.
Okay. So quickly, and beginning to wrap up here, I want to get to your trades, but I want to underscore one really important point here, which is at Wealthion, we recommend all the time that people, given this really treacherous and highly volatile investing environment, that most individual investors work under the guidance of a professional financial advisor, mm-hmm. right? Get somebody who understands, the rules that are in play, who can be a good guide for you, who can help you, create a good strategy, hedge, all that type of stuff that the average person who's just too busy with life isn't super experienced in. A common pressure for financial advisors is they feel that they can't be in cash because they feel that their clientele will say, well, look, I can be in cash myself. So what am I paying you for to put me in cash? What's going on there, right? And what I always tell people is you are paying for the expertise of the financial advisor to know when to be in cash and know when not to be in cash. So I commend you for being transparent to say that, yeah, we're recently been about a third in cash right now. And it's not, you don't think of that as your money not working for you. Think 30% of your money not working for you in your portfolio. Mm-hmm. Think of that as a third of your portfolio being very strategically positioned at the right time to then take advantage of better opportunities down the road when they present themselves. So I want to commend you for being brave and admitting that you had a substantial cash position. Yeah. But I really want people to think of it that way, because that really, it's a really important part, because honestly, a financial advisor who's worth their salt right now, who doesn't have at least some cash allocation, I would argue is being way too reckless with your money. It's my opinion, but that's what I think.
And look, that's the problem is, and this is the whole issue with buy and hold investing. Buy and holding investing is fine, and you can do that. And more times than not, you're going to be right, because markets go up more often than they go down. The problem, as we talked about before, is when markets go down a lot and you're trying to buy, hold, invest, that's great. You're not going to do, you're not going to buy at the bottom because you never sold anything. So you don't have any extra cash to invest at the bottom. And you're going to spend a lot of time getting back to even. That's right. Not just the same.
It brings you back years in your planning. Right?
Yeah. That's not making money. And of course, everybody points is like, well, that's what the indexes do. Your money doesn't have anything to do with an index. The worst thing that you can do is benchmark your portfolio to an index, because all that's going to do is drive you crazy. And it's like, oh, I don't have enough risk. Oh, I have too much risk. Focus on what's important. If I need to make 4, 5, 6% a year, whatever that number is, to get to my goal of retiring safely, then build your portfolio to generate that. And don't worry about anything else. When you make 6%, great. Raise some cash, wait till next year. These are the things, though, psychologically, we do a lot of damage to ourselves by chasing benchmarks and worrying about what everybody else is doing. Do what's right for you. Don't worry about anything else.
All right. Well, look, very quickly, can you dial us through? You referenced several of them, but can you just give us a quick synopsis of the trades you guys did make over the past week?
Yeah, sure. No problem. So on Friday, last Friday, you and I talked about oil prices at 130. High oil prices were going to correct. And they did that very sharply Tuesday and Wednesday of this past week. So, we we had some very overweight positions of energy stocks in our portfolios. We were just basically took profits, reduced them back down to their portfolio target weight. And Adam, this is something we should probably talk about maybe next week, is talk about position sizing and why that's important. But then also on Tuesday, we kind of got this sneaking suspicion that we were probably going to get a rally, regardless of what the Fed said. But our hinge was that Fed would probably come out, do 25 basis points, and really just kind of stick to the party line. They were going to do anything to disrupt the markets, and that would be enough to probably get this market to jump. So we added to some of our growth stocks that we're going to hold our core equity, kind of core growth stuff. So Apple, Microsoft, Nvidia, AMD. And we actually bought some more Ford that we like a lot from a value basis, also added to our Procter & Gamble position on the value side. So we added more to growth than we did to value, but we also actually added to some of our value side as well, because we are keeping a balance in the portfolio between value, which is performing better right now. Growth has been in a lot of pressure. We reduced that a lot. So we're starting to just try to buy a little bit of that growth side of the business, of the portfolio now, at depressed prices, because if we get into a deflationary trend, money will rotate back towards growth that can generate earnings growth in a deflationary environment, which we'll be in later this year. So just trying to opportunistically pick through things, but don't think that we're just going to buy them and then we bought them, we're just going to sit on them. We may be sitting here 2 weeks from now going, oh yeah, remember those growth trades we bought? Yeah, we took profits in them. So, this is going to be a year that buy and hold is going to be very frustrating. This is going to be a year, because of volatility, that we're going to have to be a little bit more of a trader mentality to kind of play with these swings we're going to get out of the markets.
All right. Well, look, many more questions. We're going to have to save them for next time. let's earmark to talk about position sizing next week. In closing, I just want to get your reaction to something kind of funny that went on in the markets, but it raises an interesting question based upon our discussion last week about stock buybacks, which is meme stock AMC surprised, I think, absolutely everybody in the investing community by purchasing a junior precious metals mining company a couple of days ago. I see you nodding and smiling here. There's a lot that could be said about that deal. If you're interested in learning more about it, Doomberg just released a really excellent write-up on it. But the interesting thing that it raises is the AMC was sitting on a bunch of money, and they decided to diversify some of their cash into a mining company. And, you know, what it got me thinking of is you and I were talking about stock buybacks and kind of what a massive scourge they are right now. But the rationale that's always used to justify a stock buyback is, well, we looked around and the best investment we could find was investing in our own company. You know, we think we've got the greatest prospects out there. And I'm always kind of like, really? Like of the millions of potential options out there, your stock was at the very tippy top of that list, right? And, you know, I think the company they bought has an awful lot of problems. But I think in some ways that companies that are sitting out a bunch of excess cash, you know, like investing in some real things, you know, as sort of a diversifier, and maybe in their way, what they're thinking, their minds, they're thinking of is, hey, we got all this cash. Maybe we'll just diversify some of our cash reserves by holding it in gold and silver in the ground. You know, I think it's kind of interesting. So anyways, what do you think?
Well, so I think it says, I think it screams a couple of things, and I don't disagree with you. First, you know, we did the whole rant on stock buyback, so we won't do that again. But, you know, look, when a company buys back its own stocks, that is the least best use of cash. And that means that really they have no other option. This is the interesting thing about Warren Buffett. Warren Buffett is now buying back his own company stock because he can't find anything else to buy because everything's overvalued. Tells you a lot about what's going on in the markets and the economy. But I think that this deal by AMC is interesting because, first of all, they use the retail traders that ran up the price of their stock to the moon, right? Rocket ship. And then they went and they sold $500 million worth of stock into the market. So they raised $500 million in cash on the back of these retail traders who have now been hammered into the dirt over the course of the last year as the stock price went back down to back down towards what its real value is. So you're right. Now they're sitting on all this cash. Well, the investment is kind of an interesting investment, and I can see why they did it. But what that really tells you is they see no value in their business. Remember, the whole AMC run-up was, this is an underfunded, this is an undervalued company. People don't understand that everybody's going to go back to the movies eventually. And, you know, no, they're not. They're going to stream it on their video at home. We knew this was coming 2 years ago.
Exactly. And the pandemic just forced everybody to buy even bigger screen TVs and create their own home studios. And now a movie ticket with inflation costs like $200 to send your family to the movie. So watch it for $20 on Xfinity, right?
Exactly right. And so what AMC is telling you is that, hey, we've got $500 million. Now, what can I do with that $500 million? Well, I could go open up a whole bunch. If I really believed in my business, I'd go open up a whole bunch of more movie theaters, right? I'd go build some multiplexes in every major city across the country, whatever it is. Why not go buy a movie production studio to start producing some better movies? Because the crap that's been coming out lately is terrible. So how about some better movies to show when you're exclusively in your theater that don't go to home cinema for a while? You know, let's go back to the old days. But they didn't do that. They went and bought a mining company that has absolutely nothing to do with their business. So yeah, it's a nice diversifier, but I think it tells you a lot that they don't really believe in their business surviving. And, you know, this is going to be a problem, I think, for AMC down the road. And I think it may actually get them into legal trouble down the road somewhere as well.
It may. I mean, there's a lot about this specific deal and the way that it was done that you can read the Bloomberg report,
It's a little fishy.
Yeah. But it did make me think that, you know, hey, you know, there's a lot of better use of the capital that is being used for buybacks right now than besides just enriching the pockets of the top executives at these companies, right? So, all right. So in landing the plane here, Lance, the point you made about Warren Buffett, you know, buying his stock because he truly, literally can't find anything else to invest in right now. And of course, Warren's got a really... he's got a big constraints because there's a lot of things he can't buy just because he's too big, right? He needs really big investments, and there
he could buy AMC.
Aren't that many companies that size? Yeah, and he's not finding of that small selection anything good.
Right.
But along that theme, I was talking to a financial advisor today who specializes in high net worth individuals. You know, these are people that have had a major liquidity in their event in their life, usually a business that they sold, but people that are sitting oftentimes on, you know, 20 million, 100 million, you know, in sale proceeds and trying to figure out what to do with it, right? So that's the clientele that he operates in. And he was telling me, he said, you know, that person's biggest challenge these days is in the past, you know, there's sort of always been one sector, one asset class that was doing well, at least, that they could get excited about and put money in. But he's like, right now, they're all basically telling him there's just no good options. Mm-hmm. And I think that that's just a parable for the whole system at large, you know, whether it's this, you know, guy with 20 million, whether it's a Warren Buffett or whether it's a guy with $100,000 who's looking where to put that in right now. There just really aren't very good options right now, given where we are in the macro story. So, you know, to your point, an active approach is almost kind of necessitated right now, because there's no place where you can set it and forget it and have confidence that it's going to do you well over time. You've really, right. A, got to be diversified, and B, you got to be very selective and kind of nimble.
You do. And look, and you know, I think the big risk coming up the rest of this year: economic growth, earnings disappointment, Fed hiking rates, inverted yield curve. Pay attention to those, and I think you'll be able to navigate the markets pretty well.
All right. Well, we're going to have to leave it off at there. Folks, if you are continuing to enjoy these weekly market recaps, do me a favor, hit the like button, and then click the subscribe button below if you're not already subscribed to this channel. If you've got topics you'd like to see me and Lance discuss in the future, just let us know in the comments section below. Lance, look forward to doing this with you next week. I'll be piping in from the road from a super secret location, but I'll see you then.
All right. See you then. Thank you.